Although some see the belligerent attitude of the Trump administration toward Venezuela and other Latin American countries, and the rest of the world for that matter, as flowing out of the Monroe Doctrine of 1823, others think the doctrine was basically a non-interventionist statement by President James Monroe. KGVM contributor David Rosenberg spoke with University of Montana history professor Richard Drake about the doctrine and the impact it's had on U.S. foreign policy.
The Monroe Doctrine and Venezuela. I spoke with someone recently who was talking about how the Monroe Doctrine wasn't meant to be an interventionist kind of document, that it was really just to make sure that Latin American countries could get help if they needed it against European colonial powers. And he thought it should be more accurately called the Polk Doctrine because of President Polk's war on Mexico that Lincoln called an imperialist land grab. What do you think about that?
There's a great debate among historians about the real intentions of American leaders at the time the Monroe Doctrine was promulgated. And you've just articulated one side of that debate. I think the other side is best articulated by the historian William Appleman Williams in a book called The Contours of American History. That book appeared in 1961. Williams was the premier revisionist historian in American history in the second half of the 20th century. And he argued that the Monroe Doctrine really was a manifesto for empire. And people in Latin America understood this very well, even from the very beginning in 1823, when that doctrine was first announced. In fact, in an article I've written recently for Jacobin on the Monroe Doctrine, which I know you've read, a pioneering Latin American historian by the name of Hiram Bingham III taught at Yale, a very heavily published and well-recognized authority. He also was one of the discoverers of the Incan city of Machu Picchu. And he was living in Latin America, in Argentina, actually, at the time of the Spanish-American War, which is another war of expansion in Latin American countries for the United States. We acquired, of course, effective control of Cuba in that war, as well as Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines. It was an epic land grab by the United States. And he was living in Argentina, Professor Bingham was, and he recorded in a famous article that he wrote in 1913, The Monroe Doctrine, an Obsolete Shibboleth, published in the Atlantic Monthly in June of 1913. He reported his experiences down there and how people were viewing the Monroe Doctrine and how they had viewed it really all through the 19th century as a manifesto for the American empire. And so this great debate has unfolded. I think William Appleman Williams and the people on his side of the debate are right in the discussion about the Monroe Doctrine. That this really was the moment when the United States was saying, in effect, that we are going to be in charge of our backyard, our sphere of influence.
Do you think it was because they were the first independent country in the hemisphere and that those others needed their protection?
I think that's part of it, but there's also an economic part of it. The United States was the first country not only to gain its independence, but also to develop the economic power that would enable it to become the dominant nation in the Western Hemisphere. And so I think there are both political and economic factors that play into this thesis that the Monroe Doctrine really is the beginning of the moment when the United States is going to be the dominant nation in our hemisphere. It's interesting that another writer, early 20th century writer, William Carlos Williams, the poet primarily, but the author of a really fascinating book with that sheds a lot of light on the historical background of the Monroe Doctrine, title of his book is In the American Grain, came out in 1925. And he tried to explain how the peoples of Latin America, the indigenous peoples, first encountered Western Christianity, the time of the Spanish conquest, when people like Hernan Cortes, Juan Ponce de Leon, came and conquered those peoples and really reduced them to slavery. And what William Carlos Williams shows in The American Grain is that the Spanish conquest is just the first phase of Western control over Latin America, that there would be other imperial conquest, one of which begins with the Monroe Doctrine. So we have to think of the Monroe Doctrine as
even though the U.S. wasn't an expansionist power at that time, but you're saying it set the stage for
getting
it
ready,
later.
Getting ready. And of course, I'm sure many of your readers are familiar with your listeners are familiar with Eduardo Galeano's The Open Veins of Latin America. It's a very famous book in which, from a Latin American perspective, he tries to show how the Monroe Doctrine is just what he calls one more infamy in the history of infamies that have engulfed Latin America, beginning with the Spanish conquest, then the British came in, then the Americans came in. And what Galeano does in The Open Veins of Latin America, published in 1971, is to show how the contemporary form of exploitation that obtains in Latin America really originated with the, really 1944, the Bretton Woods Financial Conference, the creation of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, which in conjunction with American corporations, this is Galeano, constitute the contemporary 20th century form of exploitation that obtains in Latin America. But for Galeano, the American phase of this domination began with the Monroe Doctrine. And now you have people like Donald Trump and the members of his administration, Stephen Miller and others, Marco Rubio, really citing the Monroe Doctrine as the justification, an up-to-date interpretation and application of the Monroe Doctrine, really is the justification for what we're doing in Venezuela today. So I don't think you can really eliminate the Monroe Doctrine from a serious discussion of what's going on today in Venezuela and what is likely to go on in other countries. If you read this document, I just got through reading it again, the National Security Strategy of the United States, the document that appeared in November of 2025. They mentioned the Monroe Doctrine prominently in that 2025 foreign policy statement. Yes, we are following in behind the American leaders who have come before, updating it for the 21st century.
So that's all the various U.S. policies, the big stick diplomacy, the good neighbor policy, the Alliance for Progress, were all of flowing from that.
I'm glad you mentioned the big stick foreign policy of Teddy Roosevelt, the so-called Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, 1904. At that point, in fact, even Venezuela was the flashpoint for that Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, because of financial problems. European creditor nations were threatening to invade Venezuela, to take over its financial institutions, to get their money back. And so in order to prevent European involvement in Latin America, the Roosevelt corollary held that the United States would take over as sort of the enforcer of the capitalist system in Latin America, that we would be responsible for making sure that payments were made, and that in order to remove this possibility that other nations would come in, we would continue in the Monroe Doctrine tradition to run our backyard. That's basically what it has all been about. And of course, what this national security strategy of the United States really argues that we're now going to apply these Monroe Doctrine ideas to the whole world. We really need to make sure that our system has a kind of global application. And that's really what's happening. The Greenland episode, I think, comes under this. We want it, and so we're going to get it.
So this is very different than how they used to couch their ambitions in rhetoric about freedom and democracy and helping out other countries. This is just very direct.
From the William Appleton Williams perspective, I'm writing an intellectual biography of him now. It's about to go off to the press. But his idea was that all of those marketing plans, the Alliance for Progress, the Good Neighbor, all that window dressing to conceal the economic, political, geopolitical realities driving American foreign policy, beginning in 1823.
Although, was say, the Good Neighbor or the Alliance for Progress considered by some in Latin America to be a shade better than what had gone before? Or would you say that nobody was fooled?
I mean, from the standpoint of historians like Hiram Bingham III, who lived there and had many friends and colleagues who kept him apprised of the situation in Latin America, said, no, I mean, the people who were informed and who followed these events as scholars and policymakers understood full well that the big stick diplomacy really illuminates what the realities of American foreign policy in Latin America always have been. And I think Eduardo Galeano in The Open Veins of Latin America makes that point with great emphasis. Yeah,
I'm thinking, for example, Nelson Rockefeller goes down to Latin America and there's a massive protest against him. But then Kennedy goes down there and he gets a much warmer reception. Is that just imagery? I mean, people were conscious that Rockefeller had a lot of financial interests in Latin America. And so maybe it made it easier for them to realize that he was not doing things in their interest. But I do remember that, some American leaders were received more warmly.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, some are more effective. Some are better at marketing than others. Probably the supreme master marketer in American political history was FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But Kennedy was sort of in that tradition, trying to present American foreign policy in Latin America as an expression of human rights, of democracy.
And we'll send the Peace Corps.
Yeah, we'll send the Peace Corps, and if that doesn't work, we'll send the Marines.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of what you've got there. If the easy way is sufficient under the needs of the situation in Latin America, we'll do that. But if the easy way, the presentable way, democratically speaking, is not sufficient to the needs, then we'll use force. So either way, we're going to run things. And we can do this in a way that is friendly sounding. But behind that facade, there's always the threat of force. And of course, it's Stephen Miller, who's one of the key figures in the Trump administration today. He's the deputy chief of staff of policy. He recently gave an interview, I think, on CNN, with Jake Tapper, in which he says openly that foreign policy is not about international law. It's about who has the power to impose his will. It's sort of an echo of a point that Thucydides makes in the Peloponnesian, yeah, the history of the Peloponnesian War. This is often repeated. The synthesis of his argument is the strong do what they have the power to do, and the weak accept what they have to accept. That's the rule.
Some would say, well, the United Nations was created to prevent some of that, and the post-war establishment of international law,
yeah,
was set up to do that. But
that
somehow,
that has not been translated into reality. That's sort of a rhetorical aim that was noble and a consummation devoutly to be wished, but the consummation has not occurred. And so as present events in Latin America, in Gaza, all over the world, illustrate. This is the age of force. It's not the age of international law. It's not the age of the United Nations. These are marginal factors that are only invoked when they can promote the advantages of the power structure. When they don't serve that purpose, they're ignored.
So do you see Trump actually trying to take over Venezuela with a military there that isn't particularly amenable to that, or a million people in militias? Do you think he would actually try to do that, or would he use some sort of economic leverage to make them a deal they can't refuse, something like that?
David, there's a great debate among analysts, political analysts, foreign policy analysts, about Donald Trump. Is he insane? Is he really this ultra-shrewd practitioner of realpolitik in the manner of Otto von Bismarck?
Is he a megalomaniac? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard to say who's right there. But certainly from what he says, from what is written in the National Security Policy Statement of November 2025, from what they say there, we are going to run Latin America to our satisfaction. They say that right there.
Seems like there'd be too much resistance to that.
Well, yeah, there would seem to be. So far, there hasn't been the kind of resistance that many analysts predicted when, on January 3rd, this kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro occurred. But that could occur. And so if Trump is in the tradition of Otto von Bismarck, shrewd, ultra-realistic practitioner of realpolitik, then he won't go in there militarily. He'll try to do things through Delcy Rodriguez, who's been the new appointee to be president, who's going to be there at our sufferance. She'll only be there as long as we want her to be there. But if he's not in the Otto von Bismarck tradition of ultra shrewdness in how he is managing things, if he is bereft of his senses, as some people claiming to be well-informed are saying, then yeah, he will be heedless about what he does. He just said in that interview that he gave the New York Times just a few days ago, someone on that Times staff asked him, what are the limits of your power in Latin America? He said, well, the only limit is my own sense of morality, my mind. Those are my only limits. I pay no attention to international law.
So is this worse than like a mob boss who would consider what the other families are doing? Is this just totally out of control?
Could be. Could be that. You know, the more optimistic people are hoping that there's a deeper level of intellectual vitality present in his thinking. But it may not be there. It may just simply be what Chalmers Johnson, you and I have talked about him before, very famous political scientist at Berkeley, taught there for many, many years. And in his marvelous book that I never tire of reading, the Blowback Trilogy, those three volumes, he published early in the 20th century. He said, you know, what's happened in America over a long period of time with the onset of the American empire and their various ideas about when that American empire began. William Appleton Williams said it began when the Pilgrims stepped onto Plymouth Rock in 1620. And for the next couple of hundred years...
Not Jamestown?
Jamestown? Yeah, that the American empire, the process of building the American empire was confined to the American continent. But then in 1890 really, the frontier ended. And from that point on, American reach in the world, its economic reach and its military reach expanded around the globe. And so what's happening now, again, I'm getting back to Chalmers Johnson, as a result of all those forces building the American empire, and it became supreme in the world after World War II, 1945, the Bretton Woods Financial Conference of 1944.
That some say Trump is trying to upend. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but he's really taking it to another level. He's upending it, but he's not eliminating the factors that created it. But it's Chalmers Johnson who says that an empire doesn't need a president. An empire needs an emperor. And that's what we've got. The Congress has become absolutely dysfunctional and unimportant in American foreign policy. It just doesn't play a role.
There are people in Congress who are trying to change that, but they don't seem to have enough support.
No, they're isolated voices in the wilderness. And
there are these other countries in the world that, you know, outside of Latin America as well, who want to oppose the U.S., you know, the BRICS nations, for example.
Right.
And Trump himself has said something about, you know, those countries should have their spheres of influence. I don't know how serious he is about that. So it might not end up as total U.S. dominance, you think?
Well, that would be a consummation devoutly to be wished, not to have total U.S. dominance. As Lord Acton, marvelous British historian of the 19th century, observed, power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. This is the situation we have. There's no countervailing force that is blocking Trump in any way. The Russians, the Chinese, powerful and important as they are, have really not been factors in these recent developments. They're not doing anything.
I'm just wondering if people, you know, some of the powers that be in the U.S. besides Trump are looking at this and thinking, this is totally wacky. We have to do something about this guy, you know, kind of like they did with J. Edgar Hoover, as some would surmise.
You know, I'm sorry to say, I agree with you, but I'm sorry to say that, I mean, such critics seem to be confined to listeners of radio programs like yours.
Yeah.
They don't really play a role in the power structure. The power structure is unipolar. It's bipartisan, and there are these independent voices. We praise them whenever they utter a peep of protest. I'm all for them. But in terms of their influence on events, it seems to be negligible.
That's University of Montana Professor Richard Drake speaking with KGVM contributor David Rosenberg. This interview was released on February 3rd, 2026.